when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome back to Wicked Problems for this Good Friday edition. It's been a big week for measuring the health of the climate tech sector here in the UK and across Europe. The question that still remains on everyone's lips is how much of a draw the US Inflation Reduction Act is going to be in bringing some of these companies to make the decision to relocate from here to there. Later on, I'll be speaking to Neil McLaughlin from the Startup Coalition, who launched their big new UK climate tech index this week, and we talk a little bit about that question. But first, we have our panel discussion. I am here, very excited, Ben Cook, Earth Editor of The Times, and Freya Pratty, the climate tech reporter for the FT-backed Sifted. Welcome to both of you.
Hi, thank you.
Good to be here.
Ben, let's start with you. Tell us what the week's been like.
This week, I published a piece about a company called Parallel Carbon, who are a direct air capture company. And actually, uniquely, they've got this process which actually takes carbon out of the air at the same time as making hydrogen. So they're kind of killing two birds with one stone. I spoke to them because they've recently announced that they're actually moving their head office from Manchester to Jersey City. I thought that was really interesting as a kind of microcosm of the effects the Inflation Reduction Act is having on the direct air capture market. Because it includes this enormous subsidy for direct air capture of $180 a ton. And I was talking to Parallel Carbon's chief executive, Ryan Anderson, about how that had affected the company's decision to move over there.
Right. And they were saying that the tax incentives weren't the only reason they'd moved. But I loved your intro in the piece talking about the fact that investors have been at them for a while saying, like, why aren't you moving to the States yet? I mean, I'm curious. I would love to hear why they're going to Jersey City as opposed to Austin, where in Texas, where everyone else seems to be going. But we might come back to that. Freya, you've covered the impact of the Inflation Reduction Act across, not just the UK, but Europe, in its kind of being this singularity that drawing in kind of founders and funders from across the climate tech ecosystem. So, I mean, what was your reaction when seeing the story about Parallel Carbon? I mean, I presume you've seen lots of other founders who are in a similar position.
Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like when the act was introduced, there was this big foretelling that we'd see this happen en masse. I think it's been slightly, from my perspective, in terms of European companies, it's been slightly slower than I might have thought. I guess maybe moving operations is actually quite a huge deal, but particularly in the area Parallel Carbon's working in. So Climeworks had already made moves into America, but I think it was 2 weeks ago announced a headquarters there. So proper cementing themselves. Who else have we seen? Freya Battery, sharing a name. They moved their headquarters. I think they've moved most or like all of their operations there now. There's also the founders so Fuse Energy, this is the company run by Alan Chang from Revolut. He said to me a while back that he's at the moment they're expanding to America, that he had said to me a few weeks ago, if he could start over, he would go to America first. So there's also that dialogue going on. But then I think you also do have, it's important to remember, you do have some companies that are still getting a lot of money in Europe. So I spoke to one of the investors in Northvolt recently who was sort of like, it's okay here, but Northvolt has got this enormous direct investment from the German government. So there are like pockets of luck here. But yeah, I think it will continue to happen. Like the story from Parallel Carbon shows that it will continue to happen. And also when you're talking about investors being the ones pushing over, I think I've definitely heard that dynamic with founders saying like, our investors really want us to go over there. So that's interesting.
So Ben, I mean, do you know, because again, I was involved in a startup where, you know, we started in Ireland and in fact, we wound up opening our US office in Austin in Texas. So I'm familiar with the town. Climeworks, that's where they're going to put their HQ. And then Moto Energy, I think, actually opened their operations there, the kind of battery energy trading company out of Birmingham that opened up operations in Austin, Texas. But yeah, Jersey City, I mean, I guess you're close to New York, but yeah, you're far away from where like a lot of their operations might be. So like, what was the deal with going to Jersey City?
Yeah, I didn't actually ask them that, but it's a really good question because Jersey City is not going to be where they're capturing and storing carbon. You know, they, like a lot of the other direct air capture companies, have their eye on the southern states because they have this amazing combination of really cheap renewable energy, the strong winds going across the Midwest, and a lot of solar in the south, a lot of cavern underground in which to store the carbon once they've taken it out of the atmosphere. So that's a good question.
Texas, I've partly because of a weird flex of regulation when George W. Bush was governor there, that basically anybody who wanted to could set up a wind farm anywhere. So that they became, with all the natural conditions, became quite a capital of wind energy. And now solar is really also ramped up there. But it's a market of 320 plus million people, from the largest capital pools in the world. And I guess the same dynamic in other sectors seems to now be playing out here. And I suppose for founders, yeah, I guess, to have a good answer to the question, if your board or your early investors are putting to you, like, why aren't you going to the States?
Yeah.
I mean, I imagine you probably are sitting there going, I guess we need a good answer to that question, guys, without not just going to up sticks and go. Freya, what have you heard about other companies? Their rationale is, other than perhaps they've got an investment like Northvolt from the German government, why would you stick with Europe?
That's a good question. I feel like you find pockets of the tech scene where there is pride in the... I used to live and report on France, and I found this particularly there. There's a real pride in like growing the French ecosystem. Maybe it's sometimes that's probably not perhaps enough to draw an actual kind of business to stay. That's a very good question. I should ask more people why. I've spent a lot of time asking the people who are leaving, why are you leaving?
Right.
I should do some more digging into why people are staying. There's actually, I heard recently of a company that's moving from America to Germany, which I think is interesting. I haven't spoken to them, but yeah, that's a good reminder. I should do more digging into why people are staying.
Interesting. Ben, before we move on to the next item, anything else that in terms of Parallel Carbon, I thought was a great example of exactly the kind of story that I suppose the government here in the UK and other governments across Europe are hoping to not see told, whether it's just the UK or Europe, you know, writ large. Should people be concerned about companies like Parallel Carbon, more of them making this kind of a move?
I think they definitely should be concerned, yeah, because the thing about the tax credits in the Inflation Reduction Act is that they're actually a lot easier to access than a lot of the forms of government subsidy that are more popular on this side of the pond. The one thing that I keep hearing from various companies, including Christopher Jackson, who's the chief executive of Protium Energy, is that actually a lot of the subsidies that are on offer for companies, at least in the UK, are harder to access than the tax credits in the Inflation Reduction Act. And so if you take Protium Energy, it's currently having to wait around for the government to decide exactly how the hydrogen business model will work. And then when it has decided that, it will be a contract for difference, which will require the government to work out how much it's reasonable to assume it will cost Protium Energy to make its hydrogen, and then how much it's reasonable to subsidize them for it. And that's a lot of kind of bespoke calculation compared to just turning up in America as a hydrogen producer and being given a $3 tax credit for every kilo of hydrogen you make. So I think a lot of companies are really attracted to the certainty of that. I think the one interesting thing about Parallel Carbon, though, one thing that Ryan Anderson, the chief executive of Parallel Carbon, really stressed to me was that in terms of geography, you know, the UK is actually an amazing place to be running a direct air capture facility because you've got all the amazing renewable energy resources of offshore wind in the North Sea, and you've also got carbon storage potential under the North Sea. And so the way he explained it to me was that the thing holding the UK back is nothing essentially geographical. It's more to do with regulation. And so if the government were to give a bit more support for companies like his, I think it would be perfectly feasible to think that the UK could build its own direct air capture in.
Right. It'll be interesting. I think there's a lot of expectation and anticipation on the sector here in the UK, certainly. When I saw Claire Coutinho speak at Chatham House, she has doubled down on setting out expectations for both carbon capture and carbon removal being an important kind of growth industry here in the UK, but also kind of helping to balance against their other, adjustments on their net zero strategy when it comes to keeping things in the North Sea flowing. But one of the other things that's been, you know, very much in the news over the last couple of months has been this prediction that electricity demand, which has been kind of flat for 20 years across most of the developed world, has really started to spike. And the IEA pointed to there being the potential for there being a doubling of demand for data centers by 2026 for electricity around the world, driven in part by AI. I've talked to people in the sector, and they say that the difficulty with training an AI model is that, you know, data centers used to be really boring customers for utilities. Like all the utilities used to be able to have, companies wanted to be able to promise them that none of the nasty stuff, the weird frequency changes and stuff happening on the grid, that won't interfere with your data center. Now, it's the data center that's interfering with the grid because of all this volatility with all this stuff in terms of training an AI model. Lo and behold, our faithful reporter, Freya Pratty, interviewed a company called Oriole this week. And so, Freya, tell us about the company that you were talking to.
Yeah, they're really interesting. So Oriole was founded, I think, April last year. So they're quite a young company. They're a spin out from UCL. And they are working on, so it took me a while to get my head around it because I don't report on AI full time. But they have, in a data center, you would have chips, GPUs connected together. And there's been a lot of iteration on the GPUs themselves. We've seen huge companies made out of that premise. But Oriole's argument is there's been no iteration on the ways that those GPUs are connected together and that part of the process is very energy intensive. So they're replacing what is, the founder described it to me as like the Ethernet cable that comes out of the Wi-Fi box in your house, but like a much more sophisticated version. That's what's connecting them together at the moment. They're replacing that with beams of light that will transmit information between the GPUs. Which they argue, or they say their lab tests have shown, can be both faster in terms of transmitting energy and less information, and less energy intensive. And they've raised $10 million. They announced that this week, which for a company in this environment and founded, a year ago, is really impressive. And so the test now is they've proven this at lab scale. The test is kind of building it into a commercial product and getting it to customers. I think they're ones to watch. They're interesting.
Right. They're part of this movement where optical networks are replacing these traditional networks and are going to hopefully reduce energy consumption, you know, pretty dramatically, it sounds like, from your reporting.
Yeah. So they are working on, so the way they described it to me is roughly 20% of the energy consumption of a data center comes from the networks. Mm-hmm. The rest comes from the actual computer processing within the chips. And they can reduce that 20% to about 2-3% of the 20%. It's right. A lot of maths, but it's quite a big chunk, I guess, if it could work. Other companies, so Google had a project to work on optical networks. Oriole said to me that theirs is slightly more sophisticated than Google. They couldn't go into depth about how, because they said that would reveal too much about how it all works. But right. I think it's a bit of a race. There's a few companies working on this technology. It's kind of crazy you can send information in that way.
So, Ben, I don't want to gazump your own reporting. I know that you've also spoken to the or going to cover these guys. So, I mean, what's your impression?
One thing they were keen to stress to me is how important their solution is at a time when actually data centers are becoming so energy hungry that it's getting increasingly difficult to build them because it's getting increasingly difficult to get a grid connection.
Mm.
Kenza Bullion in the Financial Times has done some really good reporting on how countries around the world, including Ireland, China, Germany, have actually placed restrictions on the number of data centers that are allowed to get electricity from the grid.
Right.
So really, they're positioning themselves as a climate solution, but also as a way to get over this hurdle to growth of data centers.
Yeah. No, because as you say, I mean, I know, you know, from my own kind of conversations and sources that, you know, the conversations going on in Ireland over the last year have been pretty intense with the regulator and some of the bigger tech giants, you know, being in fairly rambunctious meetings. Saying, do you know who we are? Do you know how much of your GDP we represent? What are you, crazy? But at the same time, you're down in some cases to deciding whether or not that capacity is going to go to a data center or go to a new housing estate. Those are the kind of trade-offs that a lot of the regulators and utilities are having to look at. So it sounds like it puts Oriole in a very interesting space and one to watch. So our kind of final topic, which is on the Sifted 100, Freya Pratty, give us what you got.
Yeah, so this was a report put together. We have a team of analysts at Sifted, and they're working on these kind of leaderboards of companies for, we're going to go through different countries. We started with the UK and Ireland, and it's mapping the top 100 companies in terms of revenue. So they're looking at revenue across the last 3 years. They have to be founded 2014 or later. They have to have under 1,000 employees. So that rules out stuff like Octopus Energy, I guess, is one that would be ruled out because of that. And yeah, it was interesting. So it was a combination of outreach to companies, because not everyone obviously has their revenue out there. Outreach to companies and people coming into us and saying, this is our revenue. So it's not a total analysis, because obviously some people are secretive about this. But yeah, it was dominated by FinTech, which I guess is, we have to look at the companies that will get onto this list will have been established quite a while ago. So it makes sense that it was FinTech. That was the dominant part of the tech sector for such a long time. There are, I think, 5 climate tech companies on the list, which is really unrepresentative of the current number. But as right. I said, it's because the list is looking at revenue and a lot of the climate tech companies are older and right. perhaps raising like debt rounds and trying to get infrastructure off the ground, which is pre-revenue. The top one was Forest Bikes. We sometimes class within like consumer tech. Sometimes we put it within climate. Hmm. They're making 10 million a year and they saw something like 412% revenue growth year on year. I'll have to ask the analyst team which year they're looking at, but right. they were the top one, which I thought was interesting. They've got a really good business model, it seems like. Hmm. They combine the so this is a bike hire company, but they make a lot of money through adverts in the app. That's how they subsidize and make more money than the others, perhaps. Zenobi was on the list. Who else was on the list? Nature Metrics, biodiversity measuring was on the list. Yeah, it was interesting. It was kind of odd to think about this, so much hype about climate tech today, but in terms of revenue, this is like measuring the situation a few years ago almost.
Right.
In terms of hype, kind of. So yeah, it was interesting. I recommend you read it.
Well, we absolutely will put a link to that in the show notes, and I invite people to check that out. Any surprises from what you guys have done?
Were there any surprises? There are a few companies that haven't really been hugely on my radar that came into this when others didn't. So there's a company called Switchy, which I don't know if, Ben, you've ever looked at.
No.
But they're quite interesting. They are looking at something that's in itself not hugely interesting, but the conclusion could be quite interesting. They're looking at how we measure the environmental impact of social housing. And the idea is if we can measure it really in depth, like the use of heating and where that's heating sourced from, if we can measure it in depth, it will incentivize the companies that own this housing to make a change because they can actually prove to government or investors that they've done that change. So I thought it was, they were on this list and I hadn't come across them before. It's a good lesson that actually there are some quiet companies chipping away, making money, doing good, who I hadn't heard of. So that, yeah, they were a cool company, I thought.
We're going to take a break for some ads. Then we'll be hearing our good friends at the Startup Coalition about that, my interview with them.
So stay tuned.
Hey, here are some ads to help pay the bills. If you'd prefer a version without ads, subscribe to our member feed at wickedproblems.earth. A monthly subscription is cheaper than buying us a pint.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Neil McLaughlin, Climate Tech Policy Lead for the Startup Coalition here in the UK. Welcome to Wicked Problems.
Hello, Richard. Thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
You guys have just launched last week this Climate Tech Index. So tell us about why that was needed, why did you have to do it, and what have we learned?
Absolutely. The Climate Tech Index is tracking the fundraising journeys of the 1,000 highest-funded UK climate tech firms over the last 13 years using Beauhurst data, right? That's essentially what it is, and how much they've done for innovating to combat climate change. The index is valued at £26 billion today and has raised over £15 billion and employs over 24,000 people. So it really is so significant in the economy. So I think two things. Firstly, the index, it's a part of building an evidence base, right? So for the next stage of our campaigning, we really want to look at what has worked and what hasn't. And the index forms part of evidence-based policymaking, really, to put it simply. The second reason is that in advance of the election, although we're not 100% sure when that is, the evidence is even more important, right? And whoever wins, we really want to set them up for success in how to deploy support for the climate tech ecosystem in the United Kingdom. I also just want to make a special mention, if that's all right, of Christian Hernandez of the Climate Tech VC 2150, who did the foreword of the index and were very supportive, and also Beauhurst. But without their data, this really would not have been possible. And then finally, my boss, our deputy policy director, Charlie Mercer, who really did the overwhelming majority of work on this index and just has been fantastic. So yeah, just want to shout out.
Yeah, no, Charlie, returning champion on Wicked Problems, and also yes. Christian, our actual debut guest.
Yes, I remember that podcast. So, I did listen to that whole, I remember.
He's been very supportive, and we've been very appreciative of both you guys and Christian and 2150 and the work y'all are doing. But there are a lot of indices out there. Right. So why does this contribute to an evidence base for policymaking? Tell me how that actually works.
Firstly, we very much are constantly talking to startups and scale-ups within the UK. I think we really have our ear to the ground, and I think we just have a very unique relationship that we've spent years building. This is climate tech specifically, and I think our data is quite granular. It really is quite a proper analysis of 1,000 climate techs. And I think there was just definitely a gap in the analysis market for an index like this. And right. I think it can feed so well, we'll get onto this, but it's not just a list. It analyzes regional disparities and gender disparities and investment disparities, subsector investment disparities. So I think that's also what makes it stand out.
because you guys are very focused on the UK, as opposed to being part of a larger organization that maybe has a different remit.
Exactly.
And so you're trying to lever policy to be more supportive. Obviously, Startup Coalition is not just focused on climate tech, it's focused on other sectors, but your mission is to be able to support these emerging enterprises and the innovation that they're helping to bring to market. In that vein, if I were to not have cracked the spine of this report and just said, what's going to be in this report? Like, I would have come in with the expectation that the UK would be very good at growing businesses adjacent to existing points of institutional strength in the economy, right? Software and financial services, basically, in a cluster around London, Oxford, and Cambridge. So does the report confirm that bias, or does it paint a different picture?
Yeah, so unfortunately, it does, Richard. And I think it is changing slowly. And to be perfectly honest, when I saw the data come out and we were in early stages of looking at it, I thought actually it would be even more disproportionate to London, because I think you assume that London is just such a juggernaut that just swallows everything around it. But it is still an issue. A third of all the firms in the index are headquartered in the capital. And you mentioned the Golden Triangle. With London, Oxford, Cambridge, they make up 379 of the 1,000 firms. And
that's actually less than I would have thought, to be honest. That's actually 379 of a 1,000, given the economic weight of the Southeast. But there were some surprising regional kind of areas of strength, right?
Yes, just to clarify there, the second most populous region for startups in the index is the Southeast of England, and then the East. Sure. But the Southwest is also a bit of a regional unicorn, and that's primarily because of Overenergy Group being HQ'd in Bristol, itself being a unicorn. Otherwise, there are just a few firms valued at over 100 million, including Bennamon and Pure Drive Energy, as an example. But yeah, I mean, it's a big issue. London firms also secured 44% of all investment. And although this is 20% less than London's share of overall VC investment across the economy, on the other hand, grant funding is a lot more equitable. 20% goes to firms in London, but 17 to Scotland and 16 to firms in the Southeast. So that's a bit better. It is obviously a serious issue, and there should be definitely a change to that.
As the report itself doesn't give you the full ranking of 1,000 firms, that 1,000 is based on valuation. Is that basically what you're saying?
Yes, it's based on valuation. So total funds raised and also grant funding as well. But it's the total funds raised and their value.
Right. Again, I don't have the pleasure of living there, but I'm a fan of the Southwest. So tell me a little bit more about the Southwest and why that's been a kind of a success story. I think you mentioned in the report that if it was a company on its own, it would be a unicorn.
Yes, it really is, to be honest, Overenergy Group, as being one of the three unicorns in the report that just brings it's itself being a unicorn, but then makes the Southwest a regional unicorn as well.
Right. Yeah, I think the other two, I know one of them was Zenobi, friend of the show. Yeah. Stephen Mearson was on not too long ago, and we're big fans of their work.
Yeah.
What's the third?
It's Octopus, Zenobi, and Overenergy. Those are the three unicorns in the UK.
Right. Yeah. So that we talked about software being like the expected strength, but like 60% of the companies in the index actually have a hardware play. Is that right?
That is correct. It is 60%. And we cannot just rely on software to combat the climate crisis. It's really important. It's so scalable. But hardware is really going to be the future of this. And like you said, 60% of the firms are engaged in some sort of manufacturing, agriculture production or carbon sequestration or generating energy. We know how fundamental those are to the economy and to the future of the UK and energy security and food security. They really are so vital. Those firms alone constitute the majority of private funding at up 70% and also 78% of the total value of the index and 54% of the jobs. So they really are so significant. But just an interesting point, they also represent over 70% of the failures in the data set. And I think that really highlights how difficult it can be for firms that are very capital intensive. Yeah, it can really be a struggle for them. Overall shares of funds going to hardware has also gradually decreased over the last 10 years, but it is still the best funded technology type within the index. And I think that's definitely worth monitoring going forward.
I suppose that could be a feature of a number of different things. One of them could be just the investor profile is different than it might have been 10 years ago, in the sense that there are folks who might have been investing in two guys with a PowerPoint and a dream who now think they can pivot easily to climate tech, and therefore they understand a SaaS play or they understand a software play more easily than they say, like, how are you going to do me a heat pump that will do 30% more efficient or something?
Yes, absolutely. No, I totally agree with that point, Richard.
So one of the other things that came out in the report is the role of accelerators. So touch on that for a moment. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. I think it's really important that people know that accelerator attendance, which describes when firms use accelerators and engage with them, it's really a critical enabler for many of the firms in the index. Firms that attended accelerators raised more money on average, about 17% more money on average than firms that didn't, and obtained over 57% more grant funding. One in five startups featured in the index attended an accelerator, including nearly half of all university spin-outs featured in the index. And also, I just want to make a special mention of Undaunted's Greenhouse Accelerator. It's the out of Imperial College in London, and it is the most successful and largest climate tech accelerator in the country, led by Alyssa Gilbert, with whom we regularly engage. They've been really brilliant in this area.
Let's talk about exits. So one of the things that also comes across in the report is that in terms of regions that over-index in terms of successful exits, is something that I found a little bit surprising, was Yorkshire and Humberside. So what's up with that? What was happening there?
What's up with that? Yeah, no, exactly. I think it is a really interesting variety of firms and sectors and experiences that are worth looking into. They've had five corporate acquisitions and two IPOs, so there's no sort of one, same experience that they've experienced. But a number of the firms, Carlton Manufacturing, and they recycle building materials, and Newt Cargo, electric e-commerce logistics, and Zero's virtually waterless laundry machine. There's a variety of firms that I think really just have really gone above and beyond in their sectors. And I think it's quite brilliant that they're all coming from such a northern region and not in the southeast of London.
No, and again, very much not a software type lean in terms of the companies that are doing those exits, which is great. Okay, and then I think I want to get to gender and disparities in a moment, but the one area that I suppose, perhaps not surprising, but fastest growth in terms of the highest average raise, et cetera, carbon removals has really been nascent for a number of years, and the last couple of years has really popped as a topic for investors. So say a little bit more about what the report says about them.
Yes, like you said, carbon nature-based removals, but also waste and transport, they are some of the fastest growing, but also quite nascent, really. 90% of all of their funds have just been raised in the last 4 years alone. So they're really relatively quite new. That's 2020. So they have a lot of innovation ahead of them.
And that's both the engineered and the nature-based space, is that right?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. I think just on the top of my head, and as far as I'm aware, there is innovation within engineered removals in this country. Nature-based, and of course there are nature-based removals, but a significant amount of the projects that would be overseen or used by companies trying to offset their emissions within the UK, those projects are in emerging markets, developing nations. Yeah, primarily, that's where they're based. Obviously, the UK is geographically limited to the amount of nature-based removals it can have.
Indeed. Yeah. And then finally, you mentioned that at the top, talk a little bit more about the gender disparities that you identified as part of the report.
Yes. So the Climate Tech Index, I think it mirrors industry trends in terms of mixed gender founding teams, and that makes up 17% of the index firms.
But when we say industry trends, you mean the broader tech sector?
Within the broader tech sector. Sorry, yes. So it mirrors industry trends within the broader tech sector, absolutely. But it also reflects embedded challenges of securing funding if you are a female founder. Only 8.6% of investment went to mixed gender founding teams, and only 1.7% to firms with solely female founders. And just to make that really emphasize that fact, the average funds raised by female founded climate techs in the index was 25% lower than firms with solely male founders. Quite a striking statistic there. In the index, a firm with a mixed gender team received on average 17% less grant funding than their solely male founded firm. So there's a lot of work to be done to fix that gender funding disparity.
Let's go on to talking about the Valley of Death. What is the Valley of Death, and why is it a plague on tech companies in general, but climate tech in particular?
Absolutely. So the Valley of Death is this idea that I hope some didn't think was a myth, because it really is anecdotally such a prominent thing spoken about by founders of startups. But basically, it describes the phenomena when a firm moves through its funding rounds, and at some point, that funding just really dries up, and they are at risk of failing or they fail. So that the Valley of Death describes that point in the line on the graph where it just takes a dip, and there is right. there's a lack of firms that advance to the next stage. So by looking up at the data that's come out of this, at this report, at the index, it seems to be after Series A that firms right. really struggle to continue to Series B.
So if there's an S-curve, so it's like the first dip in the S-curve, essentially, is where that Valley of Death is, that you never get to the point of proper scaling or commercialization because you've done something novel, you get some initial funding, you get to maybe bench scale, maybe you get a little bit beyond that, maybe you get to actually pilot something, maybe you get to indeed start selling it, but then you wind up in this moment where it's difficult to actually get things to move forward.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt, Richard, I just want to emphasize also that, you know, again, this is, although this is data, and it's empirical data, it's not absolutely factual. Of course, I'm sure there are many founders that have very different experiences, and it really might vary depending on the sector and the country and the time of year or whatever.
Oh, no, 100%. Yeah. Totally understand. Obviously, Valley of Death is a fairly common concept
yes.
in the sense of
absolutely.
Been around for a while, and like certainly one of the aspects of why climate seems to be different in the same way that energy has been different in terms of Valley of Death has been that as opposed to particularly venture funding that's used to going in, being able to see a path to tell their LPs, you're going to get your money back times 10 in X years, is that the uncertainty, particularly when your quanta are much higher for a hardware business. And so therefore your risk profile is so much greater at the beginning of that curve. And so therefore the Valley of Death for software business is a lot different from I'm going to invest in a factory and I'm going to invest in actually a production line. And then, because if you don't succeed, then there's a lot more at stake.
Yeah. Stranded assets and tons of lost right. capital. No, absolutely.
And so what does the report say about what should be done about this? It's a feature everywhere, but is the UK doing enough to be able to provide later stage funding?
I think it's really tough, right? The size of the economy, the lack of fiscal headroom, limited tools in our arsenal, even if some of that is just politics and perception, it obviously does matter in an election year more than most years. Later this year, Startup Coalition does plan to outline specific support that this and future governments can provide to bridge that gap. But one possible solution could look like emulating the US Department of Energy's Office of Clean Energy Demonstrations that explicitly takes on FOAC or FOAC first of a kind risk, and it currently has $25 billion in energy assets under management. Secondly, I think enabling more patient capital to invest in startups is also crucial, right, to fill those funding gaps. The UK government's Mansion House reforms to pensions is, as an example, is a crucial part of this. And I think, and then finally, there is a role for the government to play in supporting climate techs to export more efficiently, right? We really would like to see more opportunities for scaling firms to be a part of trade missions, for example, with climate tech viewed as a part of that trade strategy as well.
Right. I suppose that'll be interesting to see how that plays out depending on the outcomes of elections this year. We've seen both major parties, let's just say, waning in enthusiasm in terms of their rhetoric. Lovely this morning to hear people talk about floating offshore wind, and that's awesome as a floating edge case for something, but it's not exactly the kind of replacement for the Net Zero Industry Act in the EU or the Inflation Reduction Act in the United States, or indeed whatever China's been doing for the last 25 years. So I was moderating an event at Chatham House a couple of weeks ago, And I did ask a number of entrepreneurs who were in the room in a kind of informal poll, are you more or less likely to double down on operations in the UK than you were 6 months ago, based on whatever's going on in the, up there in the ether? And I don't think I'm violating Chatham House rules to reveal that not a single hand went up. Said that they were more likely. Right. I guess that is it enough to just urge from the sidelines, or do we need to grab people from both old parties by the lapels and just say, it's not enough. We're not nearly enough. We want this to be a successful sector, and we have an early lead against the rest of the world, but you're blowing it.
Yeah. So I think what I'd say on this issue is that I want to, you mentioned rhetoric, and I do really want to emphasize rhetoric, right? Of course, there are a number of elected officials who are not quite as enthusiastic about an energy transition or the climate crisis as many of us would want, and I believe the vast majority of the voting public would want. But in spite of the rhetoric across politics, I do actually believe that the vast majority of politicians, in spite of what you might think, are actually enthusiastic. I know saying that might be, there might be some people listening to me like, he's so wrong, and that's absolute rubbish. But so as a part of my job, I have to follow government announcements. And you could argue that maybe I'm just drinking the Kool-Aid, but I read weekly about government investment, and like particularly climate tech. And of course, I know that there were the September announcement last year that really disappointed a lot of people in the climate tech sector. And it was disappointing to many, the rolling back of those.
Not least Christian Hernandez.
No, exactly. But there is actually a lot of investment, I think, this government has put in. And moving on to potentially a future government, and Labour might get in, I think that really there's a lot of politics happening. There's a lot of, the tabloids will really just really twist that knife. And I think ultimately what we should be judging is what the actual investments that this current government are making, and which admittedly there's absolutely room for improvement and room for more, but there has been some and it has been significant. And also judging what, if Labour gets in, what they will do in power. And not look, I'm not saying I don't want to dismiss manifestos. They're obviously incredibly important and one must look at what parties promise and whatever. But I'm maybe naive, but I would like to think I'm optimistic about a new government and what they might do.
No, that's perfectly fair. And I think, when you look at deeds, not words, there is a case to be made that although people like Chris Stark are very disheartened over the abandonment of the rhetorical consensus around net zero that seemed to be there before September of this year, that the policy framework, actually the moves have not been as radical as perhaps people who are running to keep a seat in Uxbridge or whatever might like voters, certain voters, to think. So without wanting to get anyone to any hot water or ask you to comment on that, I'll just leave it there. But look, in terms of the report itself, is there anything that you'd like to see included next year? Is there anything you wish you could have focused more on in terms of the types of questions that you want to be asking to provide that evidence base for the kinds of advocacy and policy that you're going to do?
Yeah, absolutely. The index, it really is just the start. Last year, we did a refresh to a report from the previous year, and that contained 28 policy recommendations to improve the environment for climate techs in the UK. And off the back of that, and off the back of this index, we really want to focus on consistency, policy consistency and stability. And so this year, our five main campaigns, which some of which we've already done a fair bit of work on, will be the built environment. It is a huge contributor to greenhouse gas emissions. Food and ag tech, and there's very important food security element where they both overlap. Energy, first of a kind funding, and carbon markets. So those would be the main areas that we really want to go into. Carbon markets, we've set up the Carbon Markets Innovation Forum, and that's been a group, a steering committee led by us, and then we also have open meetings and we feed into work. And for example, we're doing our own voluntary carbon markets consultation that we've been working on. I actually have to work on it later today. That we'll be publishing. So those are, they're really important campaigns that we want to really tack into going forward.
Look, you guys are doing like absolute yeoman's work. One of the things I was surprised maybe to see not mentioned in the report, is, and again, without wanting to get party political about it, is the changing regime about attracting qualified postdoc or graduate talent in the climate tech sector since Brexit been any kind of impact? And is that a question you even decided whether or not to look at? Did you even consider looking at that?
I think that's a very fair question. And I personally have spoken to quite a number of them. When we meet with almost every startup we meet with, we ask them specifically at the end of our spiel, we say our three main buckets are our talent, skills, regulation, and cash. And we say, what barriers do you have within those three buckets? And it's something I hear regularly, are visa issues and how difficult then that has been to hire talent that is not from the UK and from other parts of Europe, other parts of the world, in fact, and how it really has been difficult for them to expand and to grow as a company as a result of policies in that area. So it is totally an issue. But I think that this index, not to disparage that question that you just asked, because it's a good question, but it could have covered so many things. And I think it is just, ultimately, we just had to choose what to cover. And it could have just been so broad, but that then might have potentially diluted what the other points that were already in it and maybe de-emphasized them. And also just time and resources. I think Charlie worked incredibly hard and put so much time and energy towards this, but we can only do so much is what I'd say. But there are always more reports and more analyses around the corner. And I should also say that area would also overlap with my colleague who deals with skills and talent within the UK.
Well, look, I think that you've given us a couple of headlines of things to look out for in the near future as we head into an indeterminate length election cycle here in the UK. So we're hoping to have you back, Neil, as a regular.
Honestly, Richard, I'd absolutely love to. Thank you.
And we're back. So excited we could be joined again here with Freya Pratty from the Financial Times back Sifted and Ben Cook, the Earth editor of the Times. So we're headed to a holiday weekend, but there's no rest for the wicked. What are you guys keeping a track of in terms of stories that you're continuing to follow as we go into this weekend? Ben?
So I'm currently working on a piece that is about flood insurance and why it's getting so much more expensive. A couple of weeks ago, there was a report by Compare the Market that showed that at least for homes that have been flooded before, flood insurance is 28% more expensive this year than it was last year. I'm talking to a few people who actually aren't able to get any insurance at all. It's fairly grim, really.
Gosh, I mean, there are places in the States where it's gone to the point where it would cost you $40,000 a year to insure a property that's probably only worth $150,000.
It has been without flood insurance for 7 years because she lives in a home that was built after 2009. And that means that it's not covered under the government's flood re-scheme. And so insurers just wouldn't touch her home because it's next to the Thames. In January this year, after Storm Henk, her home was flooded. And she lost about £3,000 worth of stuff, which is a lot. But in the scheme of flooding damage, it's not nearly as much as is lost by some people. So that story that we hear again and again in climate reporting about parts of the world which are becoming uninsured. Actually, that also includes parts of the UK now as well. It's not only parts of California that are next to you, forests that are burning for crisp and so on. So, yeah, that's a fun note on which to...
A cheery thing for the holiday weekend. What about yourself, Freya?
What am I looking at? I'm trying to write something about energy companies' green electricity tariffs and kind of the more granular detail about how they've calculated that. So it's the use of REGOs, which are these certificates that show that you've bought renewable energy generation, but the link between REGOs and actual generation is murky. So I'm trying to look at that, and it's kind of all goes back to the question of advertising standards and what you call green and that sort of thing. I am also trying to write about, there's obviously been a lot of oil CVC involvement in the climate tech. Someone suggested to me recently that it would be interesting to look at what founders who've sold companies to companies that have actually been acquired by an oil company, what they feel about the impact of their tech. Has it sort of been subsumed into this giant and is having no impact, or is it really impactful? So I'm trying to find examples of people who've sold to oil companies and what they think about the impact of their tech from that.
I'm definitely looking forward to seeing that reporting. So where, if you are in fact a founder or somebody who has got an exit, even if you're not fully out and therefore you might be still covered by some NDAs or some earnouts, where can people confidentially get a hold of you, Freya, to be able to kind of reveal all?
They can email my Sifted email, which is freya@sifted.eu. I've also got a Proton mail they can go to, and a Signal email. They're both on my Twitter, which is Freya Pressy.
Hopefully there might be some people in our audience who might take you up on that. I'm going to be keeping an eye on this really interesting story that came out earlier this week about food price inflation that's being kind of increasingly baked in due to climate change, and how that's actually something that people are undervaluing, underpricing in terms of its potential impact. This was PIK Potsdam that had a study on this earlier this week, was picked up a couple places. And that was our conversation with Anthony Yousefian earlier this year, where, you know, we were picking up on this being a kind of ongoing trend, where the kind of bleeding into the general public's perception about effects of climate, we don't often think about except for these disasters. But if you were, you know, having to bake in an extra 2 points of inflation every year just for food, that's going to start to really accumulate over time. So be interesting to see what people do about that. With that, thank you guys so much for coming. I hope that we'll get to come back in a couple of weeks for a return visit. Our return champions, Ben Cook, Freya Pratty, have a great Easter weekend.
Thanks.
You too.
Thanks for listening to Wicked Problems, made possible through the generosity of people like you. If you liked this conversation, please share it and leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It really helps people find the show. If you'd like an ad-free version of this podcast, consider becoming a paid subscriber at wickedproblems.earth. You'll also get our newsletter, all our show notes, member-only goodies, and you'll be supporting media that wants to tell the stories at the frontier of climate tech, the place where people and politics, technology and capital meet and shape the future. And whether it's one you'd want to live in. Wicked Problems is written and edited by Richard Delavan. Production assistance was provided by me, Theodore Delavan. Wicked Problems, Climate Tech Conversations, is a production of Wicked Problems Limited. Thanks again for listening.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.